This 10 Talks podcast is a production of the 10 Words Project from WUOT-FM and the University of Tennessee College of Social Work.
Now I just expect you to sit there. And try not to breathe too loud.
That's the story of my life. Just sit there and don't breathe too loud.
That's the phantasm in the background, Matt Shaver Powell. Welcome to 10 Talks Bedtime Stories. I'm your host, Brittany Crocker, and I'm here with Matt Shaver Powell.
Hello.
And today we're going to be talking about hot bodies. But before you get too excited, I mean literally hot bodies. If you tuned in last week, you know here at Bedtime Stories, we're highlighting some of the most common responses from people in Knoxville's communities to our 10 words question, what keeps you up at night? Many of our female respondents responded with jokes about their hot flashes, but that's a very real thing.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not really a joke.
Yeah, and in fact, a team of Yale researchers just calculated costs for healthcare and work loss over a 12-month period for 500,000 women, half who had hot flashes and half who did not. And the team found that additional healthcare related to hot flashes for just 250,000 women totaled over $330 million.
Wow.
And the cost of work loss was also over $27 million just during 12 months. So it's not surprising that women might say their hot flashes are keeping them up at night. We've also had a lot of responses related to co-sleeping and the family bed, and a few homeless respondents in the area told us how difficult it is just to fall asleep on a hot summer night. We're going to explore these topics in tonight's bedtime story with a few guests, but let's kick it off with Dr. Bob Elder, an OBGYN from the University of Tennessee Medical Center. He is also the medical director for Women and Infant Services, and he's here to talk to us about menopause. So roughly how many of your visits would you say are related to hot flashes?
Well, there's a significant number. If you look at postmenopausal women, approximately almost 90% will experience hot flashes. And you mentioned that study from Yale that I'm not really familiar with, but it makes perfect sense. It disrupts their sleep patterns. They get fatigued. They don't feel well, so you're not going to be very productive if you're having those situations on a nightly basis.
So do they mostly occur at night then?
That is typically the trend. They tend to disrupt sleep, and they have an episode of sweating, maybe even an episode of a rapid heart rate. Disrupt things. If they have a partner, then their partner may complain because they're disrupting their sleep. and sometimes that's why the patient comes in, says if because their partner's complaining about the disruption or other symptoms. But yes, they tend to happen at night. They typically last anywhere from 1 to 5 minutes.
How do they occur?
Well, it's one of those things that's not truly understood. But we all have what's called a thermoregulatory center in our brain. And it's felt that the changes that occur with menopause narrow that center and affect the response that people have to heat and cold and the way that they maintain their body temperature. There's also some other theories about how it happens. It's not truly understood, but basically what it is the patient is dilating the vessels, especially out in the cutaneous areas in the skin, and they get this warm sensation all over.
You know, when we, a lot of reproductive cycle issues can be maybe not explained by evolution, but at least have some sort of an evolutionary hint to them. And I'm wondering where hot flashes fit into that. It does, I mean, I understand where menopause might, but hot flashes don't seem, at least on the surface, to cause any sort of or to promote any kind of positive effect, do they?
No, I can't say that they do. What I can tell you is that I don't know of any studies that have looked at how it's evolved over time, but there are a couple of things that we can be aware of. There's different responses in different races. Mm-hmm. For example, Asians are more likely to have less hot flashes. African Americans are more likely to have more.
Interesting.
One of the concerns about that was that maybe the Asian diet has more soy in it. Soy has some plant estrogen type products that may prevent hot flashes. The other thing we're seeing now is that we used to always think that hot flashes would last just for a few years after menopause. But now we're learning that sometimes patients who have been menopausal for some time can continue to have hot flashes.
And I feel like a lot of women feel that their hot flashes are just treated as a fact of life, and they don't go in for as much treatment for it. Or if they do, I've heard stories of women saying that they've just been told it's something they kind of have to go through. In the medical field, what treatments are available for continuing hot flashes?
Well, there's several. First, the most common treatment you've probably heard about is hormone replacement therapy. And overall, it's the most effective, is replacing the hormone products that led to the hot flashes to start in the first place. Because if you look at menopause, sort of a way to think of it is as it's sort of like puberty in reverse. But these patients are going through a reverse process that they went through when they started having regular ovulatory function and regular menstrual cycles back as teenagers. But the therapies that are out there, and we can discuss these at length if you like, but hormone replacement therapy is one.
Let me jump in real quickly, because in the past I remember hearing that there might have been some health risks associated with that, with hormone replacement therapy. In particular, is there a risk of breast cancer or some other health risks?
Okay, there were some studies. A big study came out in the early 2000s, a Women's Health Initiative that looked at several women who took hormone replacement therapy. And out of that study, there was noted to be a slight, and it should be slight, noted that it's slight, increased risk of breast cancer, blood clots, heart attack, and stroke. Also, there was also the benefits improvement in bone health and colon health. We, for years, from observational type studies, thought that hormones improved cardiac outcomes for women who were postmenopausal. And we still believe that in some women that can be true, but the recommendations have changed. And the recommendations now that a patient, if they desire to take hormone replacement therapy, that they take the lowest dose for the shortest amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the key to that is to individualize based on the patient and have an open, honest discussion with your patient about the symptoms they're having. And then a lot of times it boils down to a quality of life issue. How much better is their quality of life using hormone replacement versus not using, and understanding the risk?
Well, I had interrupted you. You were just about to say there. You were just about to offer some other options as well.
Yes, other options are out there. We have there's a new product that it's not really new. It's a lot of times it happens in the medical field. They'll find a new use for a product that's been out there for a while. But they've taken the company has taken the drug that is commonly known as the antidepressant Paxil, and found that in a low dose and extended release dose that it will reduce hot flashes. So there is a new product, quote, out there called Brisdale that is an extremely low dose of this product. It has no anxiety benefits, no antidepressant benefits. It only suppresses hot flushes. So that's a non-hormonal therapy. The other things that are out there that work are there's a blood pressure medicine called clonidine that can be used in patients with normal blood pressures to suppress hot flushes. Gabapentin or Neurontin, which is a drug actually for neurotic pain.
Isn't that kind of an anticonvulsant? I was on that for a while for chronic pain
syndrome. One of the things it does is suppress hot flushes. It can be used. There's some over-the-counter products. A lot of them are soy-based. And then there's some herbal remedies that are used. Black cohosh is one that's commonly used, is an herbal remedy that's available over-the-counter. So, and the other thing is just sometimes some women do well with behavioral changes. Wearing, and this sounds almost silly to say this, but wearing light clothing, keeping the temperature down, regular exercise, things like that can be a benefit.
A friend of mine, she has a little fan, a little battery-operated fan that fits around her neck like a necklace, and whenever she's having a hot flash, she just kind of turns on her fan, and it helps a little bit.
That's interesting.
I think the key is to just have a, you know, each patient has to be individualized. You have to get a feeling for how disruptive these symptoms are to their life and what you can do to try to help them improve their quality of life.
And so there's other alternatives to hormone therapy
yes.
for women over 65 if they're interested in it. But How much risk really is there for cancer with women?
Okay, you have to look at that study, and many of us were not overly pleased with the way that study was done. There's been a lot of questions about it.
Reading that there's been some new stuff coming out saying that it's totally safe. That's the only reason I ask so much.
Well, I think you got to realize that I never tell a patient anything's totally safe.
That's true.
I mean, you know, there's some risk to everything, whether it's driving to work this morning or taking an aspirin. But the risk associated had to do, I think, a lot with the way it was reported and the way the study was done. A lot of those patients were older, so they may have already had cardiac issues or other health issues when they were placed in the study. The product that was most related to the bad outcomes, although still I don't think that it's a well-done study even for this, but was a combination product, not the estrogen alone product.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that I think could have been looked at a little bit more significantly. But you have to go back and think, and I had one of the people who did that study years ago came in and gave us a talk over at the medical center, and she said, you can say it two ways. You can say the risk is real, but it's small. The risk is small, but it's real. So there is a risk. If you look at it, most of the complications, even if they doubled, they went from something like 8 in 10,000 to 16 in 10,000. So, you know, how you report something and how you state it, you know, if something happens once in 1,000 and you double it, it happens twice in 1,000. So you have to think about these numbers. And actually, I have this discussion with my patients.
It's just how you represent that data.
Right.
Do a lot of the patients bring this up? I mean, is this something that
they... You know, everyone out there, people are more informed today than they've ever been. And that's a great thing. They read a lot of information. There's a lot out there. They can get it from the internet. There's all kinds of publications for them to look at. So they come in typically with a lot of questions and concerns. And of course, we all get a lot of free advice from our friends and neighbors.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Those sort of things. And you have to sit and review that and discuss it with them and then help them make a choice that's best for them.
I guess I'm just thinking if I was at age 65 and I know that there's an average life expectancy for me to like 75, 85, maybe 90 if, you know, I wear sunscreen and take really good care of myself. But I used to do a lot of extreme sports, so that probably won't happen. But
we're not going to talk about your knees right now.
Don't look at them. So how long or how rapid, I guess, do some of these potential unsafe side effects kick in? Like, are you looking at, I have a cancer risk 15 years from 65, or is it going to happen soon and shorten my life to 67?
Okay, well, we need to back up a little bit because the average age of menopause in this country is 51.
Yeah, but over 65 is when it was said unsafe.
Right. Well, what I typically do, again, there is an increased risk, and you can give them a relative risk, but there's not, like, I can't take you individually and say, this is your risk.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have to have more of that general conversation about what the risks are. And I'll tell you, in my practice, if I have this conversation with a 65-year-old and she wants to continue her hormone replacement because she feels like it greatly improves her quality of life and feels she's getting benefits from it, as long as she doesn't have other contraindications such as heart disease, breast cancer risks, things like that that are greater, after that discussion, I'll continue it.
But is there an average amount of time it would take for hormone therapy to start presenting these side effects? I guess not an incubation period because it's not a virus,
Not really.
Okay.
So the recommendations are to use it, again, for the least amount for the shortest amount of time. That sort of seemed to have – there's a lot of talk out there about 7 years. I typically find that – you know, patient, everyone's an individual. Everyone's different. You got to sit and talk to the patient. Mm-hmm. I think that's the key is really individualizing this therapy.
How can women's partners, whether that be their romantic partners or just their family support system, kind of help them as they're kind of making this transition and experiencing hot flashes and things? Because I feel like when my mom started getting them, I remember I would just be like, well, that's weird. and kind of be like, please turn the air conditioning down. Like, it's so cold in here.
Well,
but how, I guess, how can people look at this as more of a normalized thing and be more supportive?
I think what I would recommend is that one, realize it's going to happen. And when it does, have a frank, open discussion with each other about it. And you need to let your partner know that maybe they notice some changes and things like that. This time in a woman's life is a very important time. It happens around age 50. Like I said, 51's the average age. Well, there's a lot of things happening at this point in your life, a lot of transitions. It's a time in your life you need to make sure you're doing some preventive measures that need to be, you know, it's time for colonoscopies and make sure you're getting your mammograms and to make sure you're got your vaccinations up to date for your age group and things like this, that you're getting proper exercise. You got to start talking about taking care of your bones and that sort of thing, because as your estrogen levels drop, then you increase your risk for osteoporosis and thinning of the bones.
You're also dealing with a time period when there are a lot of emotional changes going on as well. And where my wife would probably not approve of me telling her age on this podcast, I asked her, do you mind if I mention that you're going through menopause? She goes, oh, absolutely. You know, so our kids are getting older. They're leaving. She's, after having worked part-time for many years, going back into the workplace full-time. A lot of these changes happening at the same time.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I think those are things that you have to try to be aware of and discuss. You have to find out what other factors are happening.
Mm-hmm.
But what you really want to do is do the safest thing you can do to give these people a healthy, safe lifestyle. And a lot of that has to do with laying out what's available, talking about the benefits and the risk, and then trying to do what's best for that patient.
One of the issues that she's brought up to me, and again, from my standpoint, sometimes it seems like almost a, I don't want to say whimsical, because that's not treating it with any sense of gravity, but like a minor inconvenience. And she'll tell me, no, it's not a minor inconvenience. I can't sleep. And she says it's embarrassing if she's in public. Suddenly she's coated with sweat.
Yes, and everyone is different. And you have many patients that go through menopause and they don't hardly experience any hot flashes at all. You have many patients that they're very severe and very disruptive. And so there's not a nice clear picture of what it's going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, you got to go back to their personal history and their personal lifestyle and how it's affecting them.
Now, this particular project, this 10 words project, we're asking people in 10 words or less, what keeps you up at night? And Brittany, I may be wrong on this, and we don't have the spreadsheet in front of us, but in terms of a very specific answer, worded the same way by several people, I want to say hot flashes, if it's not the most common answer. It's certainly one of them, yeah.
And it was followed by things related to PTSD. But as far as medical conditions being specific, hot flashes was the most specific one. Oh, and I guess if you count my partner snoring as sleep apnea,
that could be a medical condition. You know, that's kind of an interesting point, too.
Yeah, because you were saying when people's partners send them in to get treatment for menopause because maybe their hot flashes have been keeping them up. Women do that to their husbands and they're like, you have sleep apnea, go to the doctor.
And that's a great idea because, you know, there's a lot of health risk associated with sleep apnea.
Absolutely.
Well, if, like I said earlier, statistically, about 87% of women going through menopause are going to experience some degree of hot flashes. So I'm not surprised at all that these folks that responded said it was significantly affected their sleep patterns.
That would explain a lot about the wages lost, too.
I thought that was really interesting, by the way, about the wages lost. I never really, like I said, I didn't take a lighthearted approach to it so much as just I didn't realize that the
$300 million for just 250,000 women, and they were all insured by Fortune 500 companies. So you have to think about also women out there that might not have this fantastic Fortune 500 company insurance that comes with work, mm-hmm. people that are working somewhere that doesn't have insurance, like your freelance reporters and your interns and your podcast hosts.
Well, I think you got to look at it. It's almost, if their sleep patterns are disrupted enough, then they become chronically fatigued. And you know, if you're fatigued, you're irritable, you know, you don't feel like being necessarily involved in normal social things that you would be involved in on a regular basis. So again, I'm not surprised at all.
Is there anything that you'd like to add?
Well, I would just say that you touched on this a bit. If you're out there and you're struggling with this, don't just assume that it's something that you can't get some help from. Talk to your, you can get help for this. Talk to your healthcare professional or seek someone out professionally that can help you with it and sit down and go through your particular situation and give you the best treatment that you can for your needs.
This has been fascinating.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a break, but after the break, we'll be joined by Caitlin Deaver from Relationship RX in Knoxville. Caitlin is also currently a peer counselor at Lisa Ross Birth and Women's Center, and she's here to talk to us about co-sleeping.
Smells like when I played gymnastics and I got stuck in those little foam cubes. I think it's the styrofoam stuff. Not styrofoam. What is this stuff called? Like mesh or I don't know. Something plushy.
Foam.
Like foam.
Foam
yeah.
Blocks of some kind. Okay. My glasses are here. Testing my own levels. Okay, cool.
It's really hot in here.
I know, right? I wish we could have a fan, but then the whole background would just sound like
I hope that's recorded.
It is recorded. All right, let's do this thing. Leroy Jenkins. Welcome back to 10 Talks Bedtime Stories. We're here with Caitlin Deaver from Relationship RX, who's also a peer counselor at Lisa Ross Birth and Women's Center. Caitlin, what is co-sleeping? Is it sleeping with another person, or is it specifically family related, or how does this work?
So there's different ways of defining co-sleeping. Mainly what I work with is babies and moms co-sleeping. The father will also probably be in the bed as well, but mainly we deal with the babies and the moms. Co-sleeping can also be defined as just the mom and the dad or the husband and the wife or just as in the same room. So it doesn't necessarily have to be in the same bed. So there's very many different definitions of co-sleeping.
It sounds like, I mean, across the world, co-sleeping doesn't seem like such a new idea, but having a name and being a practice that's being studied now in the U.S. is kind of a new thing for us. What's bringing this pickup?
So originally, when people were co-sleeping way, way back then, when, you know, moms and babies and all the whole family would be sleeping in the same bed. However, they thought that people were killing their babies by rolling over on them, that it was causing SIDS, they were suffocating them. But we didn't have any research to prove that. That's just what we were finding, is that, you know, we were suffocating them and rolling over on them and killing them. However, research has been done in this area now, and we have found that moms who are just breastfeeding are perfectly safe at co-sleeping, so having the baby in the bed with them. However, there are certain things that you have to do to make sure that it's safe. So it's important that while co-sleeping, understanding that co-sleeping is fine, it's important to be educated on the topic as well. So you still should not have blankets around the child because that will suffocate them. So just understanding that while it's okay and research has been done on it, you should only do it under specific restraints, I guess.
So going back to breastfeeding, does that mean a new mother could do it with like breast milk from the pump, or does it have to be, what's...
They've only been able to prove that co-sleeping is good for the baby and the mom if they're exclusively feeding from the breast. Not pumping, not bottle feeding, exclusively just feeding from the breast, because there's a certain connection between the mom and the baby that is going on if they're just breastfeeding that the bottle doesn't give. So the mom's not as in tuned with the baby if someone else is feeding the baby, say, or it's getting it from the bottle instead. So it's been one of the research studies has said that while if a baby were to stop breathing at nighttime nestled next to the mom, the mom somehow jostles it while she's sleeping without even knowing, so the baby starts breathing again. Because she has that connection where it's constantly breastfeeding. She understands that something's wrong with the baby, even though she's asleep, and will move so that the baby's perfectly fine.
Is it a chemical bond, or what forms at that point that makes that connection?
There's all sorts of bonds going on. Physically, I mean, everybody's seen that commercial recently where the kid's able to touch and feel the mom. So there's a physical connection. There's a chemical connection. I mean, the baby's letting the breast know that, you know, it needs milk right away. So there's even that chemical stuff going on. There's an emotional connection. The mom and the baby understand how they're feeling all the time. It's just crazy. I mean, we don't know all the ways that they're connecting, but there is some research shown that something does trigger the mom to move. And it's also been seen while the mom's even asleep, all she has to do is slightly turn and the baby starts breastfeeding while she's asleep. So instead of having to wake up every half hour to feed the baby, she just slightly turns and they start breastfeeding, and then they're asleep. They go back to sleep.
Sounds like a much more restful sleep than you often hear with newborns. Mm-hmm. What about I've read that there have been some issues with overheating and like pauses in breathing for infants that maybe fall into like lumps in the mattress or things like that created by two bodies plus an infant sleeping in the same bed.
Yeah, it definitely has to be a firm mattress. Definitely no water beds, no mattresses that like can move, like the I guess the moving beds. I can't remember what they're called.
Like the ergonomic ones from the iBed or something, sort of iBed.
And they can't be like egg carton mattresses because it needs to be really firm. Mm-hmm. Also, if you do have blankets, your baby should not be covered at all with those blankets. The baby's head should not be on a pillow. Anything that could cover the baby or get in the way of the baby's breathing should not be allowed. In fact, it should be nestled in your arm, like you're kind of wrapped around the baby, so that it can't roll over either.
Do you have to then be sleeping on your back?
You can sleep on your side or your back, simply because, you know, if you're on your back completely, the baby can't breastfeed. So there's times where you can be on your side slightly, but still holding, nestling your baby in your arm. Also, if your partner does move a lot, it's important that the baby isn't on the partner's side, that it's more towards the other side.
That was my next question about the man in the bed, or woman, as the case may be, who's not breastfeeding.
Right.
But would the person who is not breastfeeding receive any of the same benefits, or are they going to be woken up more often? What effect does that have on someone who doesn't have that bond?
Yeah, so because the baby's going to be waking up less and screaming because they're getting that milk right then, it's going to allow the partner to sleep deeper and longer as well. They're not going to be waking up as often, so that's nice. There might be a little less room in the bed because of the baby, but typically it's a discussion that the parents have together. Like the other parent will say, hey, you know, I personally am worried about rolling over on the baby. Can we make sure that the baby's on the other side? And that's a discussion that the parents will have together.
Whether they'll be in the center or just on the mom's other side.
Right. But I know some people don't toss and turn at all. Once they lay down, they're practically, you know, dead. They're not moving. And then, you know, that's fine for the baby to stay next to the partner at that point.
Okay. So you find that families sleep better, but is that across the board, or is it just like anything where it's a case-by-case basis? Are there ever just exceptionally loud children that no matter what you do, they're going to just be freaking out?
I mean, there's always going to be, you know, something, but I'm you know, I can't guarantee that you'll never wake up, you know, from the child
being
upset.
This is the Caitlin Dever guarantee, people.
But there's definitely less times that you'll wake up because, you know, half the time is the baby's hungry, the other half the time it's pooping. So, you know, half the time you won't have to wake up as much because you simply can just roll to the side and nurse. You don't have to get up. And it just makes falling back asleep so much easier.
Do people ever have to change the temperature of the room when they do this? Or do they just kind of bodily adjust to the extra heat?
Sometimes they'll need to, for sure. But the mom can cover up if she needs to, or uncover. It's not, I mean, you know, blankets can be added or taken away. So I don't know that would necessarily have to adjust the room temperature, but I know, you know, definitely the babies put off a lot of heat, so they might need to.
And diaper changes. How does that come into play? Because babies don't just wake up when they're tired. Sometimes when they go to the bathroom, it's like, hey, get me out of this.
Yeah, definitely. So when they wake up and they are screaming, since you are able to breastfeed right there, you can probably assume that the baby needs a diaper change or something else. Yeah.
So we've talked about some of the benefits of this. There's better sleep, as you said, and that emotional bond between the mother and child. Are there any other benefits?
So the benefits are that, you know, the dad feels more, you know, the dad's always there or the other partner's always there. So it's not just like the mom and the baby, you know, are doing their own thing. They're together in a bed. So that kind of helps the family. There's also less. So it's funny because SIDS happens less if the baby is sleeping with the mom in the bed. And again, it's only if they're breastfeeding should they be doing this. But they've shown that it decreases because, like what I said earlier, the mom realizes that something is wrong with the baby, even if she's asleep. So she'll move or wake up, because of those connections. So it's kind of shown that while we don't really know what causes SIDS, the mom being that close to the child realizes something is wrong and will wake up. So that connection decreases SIDS.
That's so interesting. Mm-hmm. Are there any drawbacks that you know of?
The drawbacks are that people that do it might not be as educated, so something might happen which causes a bad name for co-sleeping, and that causes the death of the child. So making sure that if people do this, they are completely educated in the topic. Another drawback could be that if the mom can't breastfeed for whatever reason, she can't do this.
Like at all, it would just be too dangerous.
Yeah, certainly. If you don't exclusively breastfeed, at least you should not be doing this. It is fine to have the crib in the same bedroom as you, or there's like a co-sleeper attachment to the bed. That'd be fine for the baby. But if you do not exclusively breastfeed, you should not be co-sleeping in the same bed.
So, what are some of the things that people need to be educated on to make this work besides just who's breastfeeding or not?
Yeah, making sure that the bed is firm. There aren't any blankets around. The pillow is not anywhere near the child, so they can't suffocate. Also, co-sleeping should not be anywhere else but the bed. The risk of a child dying or suffocating co-sleeping in a chair or a couch is extreme. You should never do co-sleeping anywhere but on the bed.
And does that mean in any position where they're just like laying on top of your chest? Because I see those little Instagram pictures all the time. You're like, look, daddy fell asleep with the baby on his chest.
Yeah, no,
that's dangerous.
That's
too
dangerous.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they should only be co-sleeping in the bed. Simply because if you think about it, the baby could roll off. The dad does not have the same connection to the baby because they can't breastfeed. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that could happen. The dad could roll over and either land on top of the child or make the child fall off. There is not any research that suggests that is okay.
Okay. So I've heard some other co-sleeping trends, and I know you were talking about exclusively breastfeeding mm-hmm. is one of the things that does have to be done exclusively. But I've been reading about some people, when they choose to co-sleep, they'll put the child to bed at first at their bedtime in another room, and then maybe go in and they'll either do other things, or sometimes partners will use that time to be intimate in like a short amount of time before the kid wakes up for the first time, and then they move the child into the bed with them. Is that any less effective than just 100% co-sleeping?
I think it's hard on the child that early on to not give them a specific place to sleep. Children thrive on routines, and they do best under routines.
As newborns.
Mm-hmm. So unless, you know, like they're hungry, you know, obviously don't starve them because they're hungry for a reason. But newborns they start a routine, whether you realize it or not. They'll feed or sleep every 2 or 3 hours and then 4 hours. Like, they create their own routines. And that's, it's funny because parents don't even realize it until it's already happened. Like, oh, wow, my child actually is sleeping every 2 hours. And the baby's internal clock is just like, I need to go to bed now. So routines have, that's shown from the very beginning that that's how children feel comfortable and safe. They know that this is going to happen next. And it's shown that they are, because they're so much more comfortable doing that, they become more independent.
Is there anything that you'd like to add?
Just that, you know, if you want to co-sleep, you should definitely look into it. It's a great thing. And a lot of places will tell you not to co-sleep, simply because they kind of take the approach of abstinence instead of educating you. You know, like with children now, they're saying, just don't have sex. They're not educating on you why not to have sex.
Or how to have it properly.
Or how to have it properly, right. And so co-sleeping is the same thing. They're just telling you not to do it instead of educating you on how to do it properly.
So at the Lisa Ross Center, do you have classes or any kind of curriculum you put new mothers through as like a boot camp of this is how you can do these things if you want to?
Yeah, so there's a breastfeeding center at Lisa Ross that educates moms on the importance of breastfeeding. And if there's any problems, they go through it with you and the baby, if the baby's come yet. And they talk about how important co-sleeping is. For the sake of the baby and for sleep wise. So they talk about that and kind of go into more detail than what I've done.
Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to have another break, and afterwards we'll be joined by our last two guests for the night, Misty Goodwin and Chris Smith, to talk about homelessness in the summer. Welcome back to Bedtime Stories. We're here with Misty Goodwin and Chris Smith of the Knox County Homeless Coalition, and they're here to talk to us a little bit about some of the issues homeless people face in the summer. So I know you guys publish a biannual study every 2 years about homeless people within Knox County. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The Homeless Coalition was formed 30 years ago. This is our 30th anniversary, and one of its initial tasks was to look into what homelessness is like in Knoxville, and so that was obviously a huge undertaking, but an important enough undertaking to where we decided that we needed to do this every other year. So we offer this biennial study where for a week we'll interview upwards of. I'm going to get this number wrong, 250 homeless individuals living in shelters, living in camps, living at different environments, and really trying to capture who they are, what's bringing them to the homeless situation, and how they experience homelessness. And so it's a valuable report. I think it provides service providers a chance to really capture you know, the population and how to best help that population. The past couple of studies we've partnered with the Homeless Management Information Systems, HMIS, and they track information on a daily basis. So homeless service providers will enter in certain information, demographic information, a variety of information based on their interactions with the client. And so we've teamed up with them, and the report actually includes a lot of their information as well. So you really get a robust sense of report full of information about homelessness in Knoxville. And that's accessible through the Knox County Homeless Coalition website. So that's accessible there, and also on the city's website.
And how much of an issue is heat and dehydration?
Well, one of our programs does a lot of outreach into the street homeless camps within Knoxville, and so we've got two guys that go out and do that. And a lot of what they see is that it is very hot. We've had a lot of rain lately, and so that's created some issues too with some of the campers. Dehydration happens, I think. We have a lot of agencies and folks that are out distributing water to Knoxville, and so when we sort of discussed this as a group, that didn't seem to be a huge issue for some of the folks that are homeless out there with dehydration, but it is very hot. More, I think what we see is a lot of families that are in their cars, that are living in their cars, and we see that it's, you know, it really impacts the kids that are living in their cars because it is so hot and it is miserable. And so a lot of families are trying to, and even a lot of homeless individuals, we see them going into the libraries or places that they can go and just stay cool and to find services and go in and try to access those during the day to avoid the heat. So
you'll have families that are even sleeping in their cars at night?
Oh, yeah. We have a lot of families, particularly in the summer, that sleep in their cars. And on average in Knoxville, we have anywhere from 100 to 200 families in any given year that are homeless. And we only have about 18 spots for families within our shelters in Knoxville. So that leads a lot of families to either double up with folks if they have family or friends to stay with. But if they don't, they end up in their cars. So we always see just sort of an upward tick of families in their cars during the summer.
Do you ever see instances of homeless people or homeless families choosing not to stay in the shelters or not being able to for any reason?
We do. Well, one of the issues with families that we see is that there's just not space. And then if they, depending on their family makeup, a man and a woman who are not married, or if they have teenage children, there's only one shelter, which is Family Promise in Knoxville, that can accept those families, and they're limited in who they can take. So sometimes shelter's just not an option, and they don't have a choice but to stay in their car. And in terms of individuals that are in the camps and living outside in tents and such, most of the reasons that they wouldn't access shelter is during the day they're not allowed to stay there. So they may access shelter at night, but a lot of the folks that are known for street, you know, being on the streets, don't necessarily like, there's a lot of curfews within the shelters and things that they have to abide by, and so some folks just choose not to access shelter for different reasons.
And I would add to that the choice to not going to a shelter is complex. Oftentimes, you know, if you think of mental illness, being in larger groups, trying to abide by the structure of a shelter program may be too difficult for some, and so it may disallow them from being in a sheltered situation. Substance abuse, substance dependency, some you know, obviously in sheltered programs you're not allowed to use within in those walls, so the choice may be to be outside of the shelter.
You mentioned some of the structure of a shelter program, and you also mentioned curfews and things like that. What kind of rules do homeless shelters have?
One of the biggest shelter we have in Knoxville is Knox Area Rescue Ministries, and so folks need to be in by 7 o'clock in order to be able to sleep there at night. And they have a certain time in the evening that lights go out and everybody has to go to bed, and that's just, you know, when you're running a shelter as large as CARM, they have to have rules in place to keep things going there. And so it's just, you know, the people that stay there, they can come and eat and they're welcome to stay and they've got a safe place to be for the night, but they've got to follow the curfew and the rule in order to be there. And so as Chris mentioned, we do see a lot of mental illness in Knoxville, and so for some folks, that's just not workable for them.
What are some of the specific dangers that you guys have seen in some of your studies with homeless people that they encounter, specifically in the hot summer months?
Well, Misty mentioned the hyperthermia or the dehydration issues, and those are obviously big. Beyond that, I think you have issues of, you know, homelessness is stressful anyway, and if you if you're in a situation where you're exposed to harsh environment, then it really it stresses an already vulnerable emotional situation. So I think in general, heat is not a great experience for most. You think about individuals who are homeless who are trying to sleep in the outside, and you think of sleep issues, insomnia, dealing with I'm using my middle class voice now, but I had my air conditioner break a few months ago, and in that situation, I had a really rough time sleeping. Think of that on a nightly basis. You think that you may become accustomed to that. I don't think you are. So there are a number of issues, and of course, insomnia deals can lead to more complex mental health problems, physical health problems. So it's profound.
Do you know of drug interactions and things like that that are homeless people on medications or have access to medications that could then even illicit drugs that could have an interaction with the heat?
There is drug use, but there's also, you know, with the mental illness, there are particular drugs that folks are taking just to treat their mental illness, and I'm sure that there are some side effects of that. You know, and I think more than anything, probably the substance abuse in terms of alcohol and just drinking during the day and creating dehydration just naturally from the alcohol. I think that's probably the bigger issue that we would see with that during the heat. I don't know, Chris, you may.
Yeah, with prescription drugs, obviously, we have a number of individuals who are homeless who are still able to access health care, fortunately. And, you know, a lot of prescription drugs would alter your ability to sweat normally. And that's true with a number of normal medications, but mental health medications maybe more specifically. Obviously, that is a problem with illicit drugs. I think, as Misty said, you know, the alcohol and heat obviously don't mix very well. It impairs your judgment. You don't really notice your physiological reaction to heat. So you may not notice that, you know, I'm not doing so well out here in the sun. You know, other maybe illicit drugs, cocaine, amphetamines, those drugs normally would cause a hyperthermic response, and that's in a normal environment. Given the heat, in addition, I think you know you're doubling your chances for a physical ailment.
And one of the other things we see in our programs, and we work a lot with homeless families with children and young children, and we have some with children with special needs, and so you've got a lot of children that are on medications, and it can be for ADHD or a variety of different things, but just given. And we've got some autistic kids and such that are on medications. And so when you're mixing, you're giving them that medication, but you're also out and you're in your car and you're hot and you've already got that irritability. I mean, that's certainly adding to probably lack of sleep and just stress on a family and, you know, the ability to have the normal coping skills that most of us would have or be able to have the energy. I think that it's very taxing on somebody's energy. I mean, if you just imagine how much that being hot can take energy out of you, I think that
especially when there's no reprieve.
Yeah.
If you're not going to the shelter, if you're not accessing the emergency care, then there's really no reprieve and you're just kind of stuck in that situation.
Well, and a lot of folks we see, they're living in their cars. They cut them off during the day, so they're not going to run them all day to keep their air conditioning going because, you know, normally they are very low income and can't afford the gas to put in the car. So you're right. They don't have access to air conditioning or fans or anything that can maybe alleviate that heat a little bit.
And there's been all kinds of social media, like service announcement type posts about animals and children in hot cars. So I can't even imagine what it would do to a person, a family, children, to live in it in the summer.
Right, right. And I was meeting with a family this morning that came in and small children, and they were coming over to just go to the library for a little bit and check out some books and just hang there just because it was cool and, you know, to give the kids a break from the hot car. So, I mean, families are as resourceful as they can be. And finding restaurants and fast food places and maybe a playground.
Hopping on the bus, going across town.
Hopping on the bus. We do, yes, we see that a lot. In fact, the same family this morning told me that they've been accessing the just different water parks that are available throughout the city and letting the kids play there just to cool off. So,
do you guys receive any kind of reports when one of the homeless people that you've been speaking with is hospitalized or sent for emergency care?
Well, our guys go out every Thursday and do outreach all day. And then as we get special calls in or inquiries from the community, they may go out various times during the week. But yes, I mean, just the homeless community in general are a very close-knit group. And so when they find out, they know about somebody or they've heard that they've gone in, our guys usually get that information and have that knowledge. And you know, have the ability to follow up the following week when they're out again and make sure that person's okay. But
what are some of the most common reasons you see homeless people end up being hospitalized?
We've had several with just strokes and seizures. We've had a lot of folks that I've been aware of that have had seizures out in the elements, and it could be just that could be part of their disability. It could be from drug or alcohol use. I'm not sure. I don't know, Chris, what would you say to that?
From a seasonal perspective, I couldn't say more than that. I mean, obviously, accidents, injuries are probably why homeless individuals are going into the emergency rooms or going to hospitals more than anything else during the course of a normal year. Obviously, during the summertime, there's an increase of heat stroke and heat-related medical issues.
What kind of emergency care services are available for homeless people that are free?
Obviously, CARM offers emergency shelter, of food, and they offer a resource center as well. So those are free for individuals. VMC offers homeless case management. VMC being Volunteer Ministry Center offers, you know, case management and a number of other resources as well. Salvation Army offers a number of services. Those are all kind of centrally located on Broadway, and those are our primary homeless services for emergency.
Okay, and I was going to say Cherokee Health has their own office and their own branch out right next door to VMC now, and they offer some just primary care and mental health care for individuals who are homeless that need that. We also have Remote Area Medical that comes out and does some different groups and opens up their doors to have assistance available. I think there's even a mobile health clinic that comes around to CARM and offers some assistance with that as well.
Thank you. Is there anything you'd like to add, either of you?
I would add that, you know, that the emergency shelters do offer, they have white flag days during the summer. Am I right in this,
mm-hmm.
Misty?
Mm-hmm.
90 degrees or higher, that the doors stay open so that there's space, there's ability to come in and get out of the heat. So that is open for those. And that happens in the winter when it drops below 32 degrees. So the doors become, the doors remain open during that time. During the course of a normal year when the temperatures aren't, are more moderate, then those doors close. With CARM specifically, they close to allow them to clean up and to prepare for the next meal, the next bedding. So those white flag days are very important. In terms of you know, what community members can do, obviously bottled water, offering, being able to offer clothing donations, white clothes, T-shirts, socks, clean things. Those are always maybe more important during more extreme temperatures. So.
Yeah, and two things I would add is one of the things that the guys said to me before I came over today is that mosquitoes seem to be really bad this year with all the rain we've gotten, and so that's kind of put people at risk and not being able to sleep at night and keeping them up. A lot of the folks are camped, you know, in isolated woods and a lot near water sources or creek banks, so mosquitoes are naturally just higher in those, you know, a higher volume and more of a problem there. So that was one of the things they mentioned. And then we have seen a little bit of an increase in just seniors that are homeless, and we've been getting a lot of calls in our office for elderly folks, and the heat certainly impacts elderly and folks that are frail more than just your average person. And so we've been responding to that need within our community, and we've get a lot of phone calls about seniors from different churches. If they're, you know, if the seniors come in and they're just kind of taking shelter in the shade on their front steps, they would call us, and the hospitals are calling when they've got somebody that they've got a discharge that they know came to them from a homeless status. So we're trying to jump in there and do what we can in those situations. Unfortunately, we don't have a great option because if they can't during the day at CARM, if they've got to leave for the day and go out and walk the streets, that's not necessarily going to work for them. And so we've got a shelter specifically for seniors, a Samaritan Place through Catholic Charities, and they have just not very many beds there, and they do the best they can, but they've got quite a bit of a hefty waiting list. Usually on average it's around 40 people.
Oh wow.
And I think that they can house like 14 to 16 seniors at a time. We're working with them. We've partnered with them at CAC to help move seniors out quickly and work with their case managers to do that and help folks get into housing so we can keep the flow moving in. But that's something else that we work with and see and have some concerns about. So.
Thank you. Yeah. I hope you enjoyed your bedtime story. Be sure to tune in to 10 Talks next week for Things That Go Bump in the Night, where we'll discuss the neuroscience of our nighttime minds and some of those introspective, highly sensitive tendencies we seem to have just as we're winding down for the day. And remember, you can always find out more information about the 10 Words Project on our website, wuot.org. Or you can follow us on Twitter at 10 Words, that's 10 with two N's, where we'll publish some of your anonymous responses to our current question every day. We also keep a running archive on Instagram, again, that's at 10 Words, and there you can see photos of all of our responses, the funny, the bizarre, the serious, all of them. Thanks a bunch to Dr. Bob Elder, Caitlin Deaver, Nancy Goodwin, and Chris Smith for joining us on the show this evening. And a big thanks to everyone on the 10 Words team and all the good people over at the University of Tennessee College of Social Work. The music for Bedtime Stories is by Todd Steed and the Sons of Fear. That's P-H-E-R-E. If you like it, you can hear a whole lot more of it on Bandcamp. Sleep tight, Knoxville.